I think that some of our shows on Next Chapter with Charlie really hit the mark, and I think this is one of those shows. Our guest, Pete Callahan, built one of California's most highly successful law firms to assume the role of chairman of the board of a fledgling charity. Since his commitment in 2015, that charity has grown nearly 400%. Pete and I served together as volunteer president and vice president of Wells of Life, a water charity. Pete Callahan is certainly one of the hardest working retired men that I know. Wells of Life would not be where it is today without his leadership and service. Our conversation today is lively, it's fun, it's informing. With that said, let's bring on Pete Callahan.
Welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours. Hey, Charlie.
Pete Callahan, it's such a pleasure to have you on the show. Welcome to the next chapter with Charlie.
Well, thank you, sir.
I'm looking forward to a very informative and interesting conversation. Now, Pete, what I'd like to do to start this show is start with a bit of a dive into your personal history. You call yourself retired, but you are working as hard as ever. And I'd like you to tell our listeners, before we talk about your retired time, about your fascinating history as an attorney, an educator, and a corporate leader. Let's begin with your law firm, CTSC Law. Tell me, how did you get involved in law, and how did you get involved in starting a law firm?
Well, way back when I was a very, very young man, 10 years old, my uncle was a custodian at the Crown Point, Indiana courthouse, which is the one that John Dillinger broke out of the jail with a soap gun, supposedly. That he had blackened with the shoe polish. And my uncle was the custodian there. And I would go with him in the summer times to help clean the courthouse. And I would sit up in the judge's chair, you know, at night and stuff like that. We went down to the jail cell. And I just fell in love with the law. And, of course, my uncle told me that the story about the shoe polish gun shaped out of soap. I don't know if you ever heard that story.
No, I've not heard that story.
He told me, you know, it wasn't a piece of soap shaped into a gun that got him out of the jail here. It was a $100 bill, which didn't surprise me a bit. But I always wanted to be a lawyer. I thought it looked like a fun thing. I wish I could say that I fell in love with To Kill a Mockingbird or something. But I was always fascinated by legal stories and legal books, legal movies. And that's what I always wanted to be ever since I was a little kid.
And so when did you begin practicing law?
I graduated from law school in 1967, and I was a public defender in Chicago for 2 years and then moved to California and decided to get out of criminal law completely and started working for a civil law firm. And I did a couple of years with an insurance defense firm. I then switched to another insurance defense firm in Orange County for a couple of years, and then started my own firm.
Now, how long did it take before you were an attorney, and then you decided to begin your own law firm? What was the time span between that?
Oh, 6 years.
6 years, that's mm-hmm. all.
Yeah, three years with one firm, 3 years with another, and then we decided to strike out on our own with a couple of friends.
Did you? Just the three of you decided to start
four
out on
your own? Four of us originally. Four? None of those four? Names are in there anymore.
Oh, really?
No, the actual firm, after a couple of changes, became Callahan, McCune, and Willis for 35 years. We were Callahan, McCune, and Willis. And then that firm broke up. My partner, Scott McCune, passed away. And we just went separate ways, and Callahan, Thompson, Sherman, and Caudill started about 10 years ago with a lot of the same lawyers and same clients and things like that.
Now, you have more than one office, right?
Yeah, we have offices kind of throughout the state. Our other big office is in San Diego. We had an L.A. office for a while. We closed that. fighting with the L.A. tax people. We had a San Francisco office that I headed up for a number of years. We had a couple of small offices scattered here and there. So our proud boast was Your California Lawyers, CTSC. And we basically cover the state anywhere between the Oregon border and San Diego.
And, did you specialize in other states? Did you do criminal law? Did you do civil law?
No, all civil. We don't do any criminal, but we do all kinds of civil law. If it's something that's very specific, we'll associate someone else in that. For example, patent work we don't do, although we do patent litigation. We're basically a litigation firm, so we're trial lawyers. And sometimes, for example, we don't do wills and estates, writing up wills and estates, but we try wills and estate litigation. So we're a litigation firm. We're trial lawyers, which gets kind of a bad name sometimes in the minds of some people, but it shouldn't.
It sounds like the fun part, though.
It's both fun and extremely challenging. I think it's I've learned a tremendous amount. For example, the first case I tried in California involved a seed company suing another seed company about how they put stuff on their seeds to make them grow more quickly and more efficiently. Who knows anything about that stuff? I learned all about that stuff, and I spent, 6 months becoming a seed covering expert. Now, I've never had another seed case, and I don't ask me any seed questions, but there was a point in time in life where I was a seed expert. So you get into various other things, and you have to dive way into them, and I found that very interesting, very fascinating.
That had to be very educating for you.
Yeah.
What you learn by how many... Now, didn't you say you tried... 260 cases?
250. When I stopped counting at that point, and I think that's probably a pretty good number.
That's a lot of cases.
Yeah, that's a verdict. That's not settlements. That's to verdict.
That's to verdict?
Yeah, mostly juries, some court trials, but most of my experience has been jury work, which I enjoy.
So is it like the movies? Does a court look like like movie courts?
There is a lot of similarity between good lawyer movies and real life. But what the movies don't show, because there's not enough time, is all of the background time that you put into it and all the preparation time. One of my favorite movies is The Verdict with Paul Newman.
Right.
Paul Newman, of course, was the individual plaintiff lawyer. I had a church against case against the Catholic Church, a malpractice case, and the Prince of Darkness was the insurance defense lawyer who had a whole crew of about 15 lawyers that were working together to beat up poor Paul Newman, and I enjoyed that immensely because that was so terribly unrealistic. We defense lawyers are the ones that are the underdogs, not the plaintiff lawyers usually, and I eventually had a big firm behind me, but don't forget my bills were being paid primarily by insurance companies, and they aren't going to pay two lawyers to work on a case or three lawyers or five lawyers or any other stuff you see in the movies. Of the 250 cases I tried to verdict, there were probably five of them where I had another lawyer with me on the case.
Really?
The rest of the time I'm on my own. And the same holds true when they were non-insurance cases. Because most clients, let's take you for example, if I came to you and said, you can hire me, but I want to hire a second lawyer, you most of the time would say, no, I don't want to pay for two lawyers. I want to pay for you. So it wasn't this monolithic group of defense lawyers versus the poor little plaintiff lawyer. Now, I should tell you also, I did a lot of plaintiff work where I was, on my own. I didn't draw a distinction between plaintiff work and defense work. It was trial work.
What was the most, what do you think, not necessarily the most, but what is rewarding to you about trial law?
This sounds terribly shallow, but winning.
I don't think that's shallow.
Winning is a tremendous high for me. I should have said doing justice, you know, and finding the truth and all those things, which is important. But the truth is illusory. It's very difficult to really determine what happened and who's right. This is a horrible thing, and I'll probably ask you to cut this part of the tape out. But
not going to happen. It's too good.
But I tend to believe my clients, and if I don't believe them or I don't think they have a righteous case, I got to the stage relatively quickly in my career where I would say, I don't think you and I are going to work together very well. I don't want to be your lawyer. At which point they invariably offer me more money. But I got to the stage where I could say, let's be very frank here, Charlie. I don't want to represent you because I don't believe you and I don't believe in what you're telling me.
Isn't that unusual, Pete? Or is that normal for people in your position?
You have to have a certain success rate and financial stability to be able to chase people away. Now, again, remember how this started out. When I told them that, they would invariably offer me more money. If I thought their case was seeking injustice, I wouldn't take it. But if I just didn't like them, I would usually refer them to somebody else in the firm and insist that, I hand it off because I didn't like them. That came later. I practiced law for, and am still practicing, for 54 years, probably for the first 20 I didn't have that ability financially, and I wasn't that independent. But I got to the point where I was as independent as a hog on ice, and if I didn't like a case or didn't like the people, I would tell them that.
You know, it's interesting. It's my career as a business consultant, as an executive consultant, I had sort of a similar philosophy in that I got to a point where I was moderately successful. And I decided I would not work for money. Money was not my driver. I charged, believe me, I charged well. Mm-hmm. But if I didn't believe in the integrity and the value of the person that I was working for, that I couldn't work for them. And I just would say, I would either resign or say, we need to find another, we need to part ways amicably.
Well, let me ask you a question, Charlie.
Sure.
And that is, did you ever have a client or a potential client where your vibe was, I don't like this guy, but I'll take it anyway, and it ever got better?
Yes.
Okay, I never have had that experience. When my gut tells me, I don't like this client, it's not going to work out, the one or few times I went further, I rued the day that I didn't follow my gut.
Well, you know, with me, it gets to where, you know, when you're doing coaching and you're doing at this time, it was called remedial coaching. There's two types of there's several types of coaching, but two types of coaching in my in my experience. One is remedial and one is high potential. Remedial is where I'm essentially hired for wrongful term mitigation. And so they think they're going to terminate this person. So let's hire them a coach, a business coach, a professional coach, have them work with a professional coach, and if they still are non-performing or not doing what the organization wants, they can terminate them, and then it's really difficult to get wrongful term compensation because they said, we hired you a coach. Mm-hmm. We hired you somebody to help you make it in this company. We invested in you. And so that was not as fun of work, working doing remedial work, because I'm usually working with people that, you know, they pretty much deserve not to be working for the company. And so that was my start. That was how you started. But after having a bit of success at that, I moved on to executives and high potentials. I worked with a lot of high potentials. I would work with executive CEOs, senior VPs and coaching them and just trying to help them improve their business skills. But then we would identify high potentials within the corporation and say, these are people, let's find out what their holes in management are. Let's patch those up and get those ready to enter the sea level or the sea floor or the E floor. That was very fun because those people, once they understood the purpose of the coaching, was to take them to the next level, not to keep their job. They have a whole different mentality.
I can understand what you're telling me because you were trying to help people. My youngest daughter is a doctor of psychology, and so she works with a lot of difficult people because she's trying to help them. But I started out as a public defender, and I didn't have choice on who I got.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I spent 2 years in the trial division of Cook County, which really was kind of the quick start to my career. There's an interesting story there, too, but I don't know if we have time for it. When I went into private practice, people that came into my office and said, I want justice, I would tell them, you're in the wrong place. I don't deal in justice. I deal in winning, and tell me, and the winning is going to be money. I can get you some money. I can't get you justice. Justice is in heaven. And if they say, well, I don't care about the money, that's a sign right away that you're dealing with somebody that's not going to be realistic, because it's always about the money. And we're not going to wind up in a place where we're both happy. And so that's a turnoff. If they come in and they've been to three or four other lawyers, that's a turnoff. If they come in with a shopping bag full of paper, that's a turnoff. And I think the key to success in the law is turning down clients, not finding clients, turning them down. You're much better off with a few clients that you can satisfy and be successful and make money for them and yourself, and you're going to build a practice that way. You're not going to build a practice by taking crappy cases.
You know, and as a result, the kind of cases that you took, you had to have a most gratifying life as a result.
I was very happy as a lawyer. I had a lot of success. I enjoyed what I did. I helped a lot of people. And in the process, I got justice and a fair result for a lot of people.
Well, before we move on to, I've really got it. I've got an agenda for you here, but I'm just kind of giving a background so our audience has an idea who you are. We've known each other for 4 or 5 years now. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure, but I just learned that you were an educator. I did not know you were an educator.
I taught in law school at a good school called Southwestern. Western State. Which is no longer in existence. And I enjoyed that very much. I taught trial practice. I taught procedure before trial, and I taught civil procedure, which is mostly statutes and technical stuff. And I got to admit, I had a hard time staying ahead of the kids. And they weren't kids at Western State particularly. Most of the people were older. Very bright people, and I enjoyed that very much.
That you know, it sounds like, once again, you know, who would have thought that executive coaching and trial lawyers have things in common? But there's another issue in common there, and that is that we are both in the service industry.
Mm-hmm. Sales,
but you're selling to get the clients,
right?
But once you have the clients, you're a servant. You're there serving their needs.
Yeah,
the law.
But the sales part of it is, I was selling judges, I was selling juries, but I was also selling my client on doing the right thing, saying the right things, thinking the right way. And you, as a coach, are selling your client on what he or she needs to do to be more successful. Usually it's not a tremendous secret that they ever occurred to them before. It's just that they rejected what their gut told them. And you're going to, I think, I've never been a life coach, but my imagine is that a life coach tries to listen to the person, find out their problems, analyze their weaknesses, and then try to eliminate their weaknesses and concentrate on their strengths and sell them on being the best person that they can be.
Yeah, you know, now the only thing I'd like to just draw a little bit of clarity here, I was not a life coach.
Oh, okay.
I was a business coach.
Oh.
A business, but
they overlap.
But the efforts, are the same.
Right.
The efforts are the same. It's just a different clientele.
Yeah.
That I'm, as a matter of fact, I worked for the last several years, I worked only with CEOs of large companies. My goal in that was always to serve them to be better at their, at what they're doing. And so...
And to be better people, because if they're better people, they're going to be better at what they're doing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I can't tell you how many of their employees would talk to me and say, help us. But, okay, so with that idea of sales, that takes us to my not-so-hidden agenda of what I want to talk about.
What's that?
And what I want to talk about, Pete, is that now... For the last handful of years, you devote probably the majority of your time as chairman of the board, chairman of the board of directors of our charity that most of my listeners know I'm involved with, the Wells of Life, a water charity that we provide water to people in Uganda. We have just this year come up with where we have provided water to 635,000 people. And that is just, water is life. And so we're saving lives, we're changing communities, but there is a big fundraising part of that.
Oh, yeah.
So there is a big sales aspect, and you are passionate about our people in Uganda. You're passionate about the wells and the service that we offer. The role you perform, besides leading the company as chairman of the company, the role you provide right now is also a fundraising role. It's a selling role. And so you spend much of your time talking to donors, finding new donors, maintaining relationships with donors, helping people understand what Wells of Life is all about. Is that not correct?
Yes, exactly correct. We do good work, but to do good work, we need money. And without the money, the good work is going to stop. So I don't like that aspect of it. I did not want to be a fundraiser. I don't like twisting the arms of my friends for money. I don't like the fact that some people won't take my phone calls and walk on the other side of the street when they see me coming. But that's the cost of it. And I have had a number of relatives and friends that have told me, look, we're not interested. We're not going to give you a dime. We don't like you working our friends. And so please stop that, which I did. I can understand. I don't agree, but I can understand that. If that's your position, I part of the key to fundraising is knowing when to back off.
What I really want to have to tell us about, you have a fascinating story of how you began with Wells of Life. And it did not begin with this, oh, this is the greatest thing.
Not at all.
Tell us about that story.
Okay, I'll tell you the truncated version. I was 70 years old or so, and I went to a St. Patrick's Day party for a charity, Irish
did
charity.
Did we already identify that you're Irish, like ridiculously Irish?
Peter Michael Patrick Callahan, as Irish as Patty's pig. I went to this Irish charity dinner, and the Rose of Tralee, which is a big fundraiser internationally. And at the table was this fellow with a great Irish accent, Nick Jordan. And St. Patrick's Day, I'll admit I had a couple of pops, a little green beer here,
of
and
course,
a little Irish
you're
whiskey
Irish
there.
For crying out loud.
And, you talk to the people at the table. And I said to Nick, so what's your story? And he said, well, I founded this water charity, and if you give me then $6,000, every penny will go to building a water well in a rural Uganda village. And I said, really? I said, that's an incredible promise. If I give you $6,000, every penny is going to go to building this water well. I said, I'll tell you what, pal. I'll give you $6,000, and I'm going to go to Uganda, and I'm going to look for that well. And when I don't find it, I'm going to come back. I'm going to put you in jail for a very, very long time. I'm going to close down your charity. Because you know as well as I do, my friend, that there's overhead in everything. And you can't possibly put $6,000, every penny, into this project. You're wearing your little lapel pin that fall from heaven like manna. You're handing me a brochure. You get these printed for free. I said, I'm tired of being ripped off. I'll give you $6,000, but you better bring a toothbrush. And he said, he looked at me very strangely and kind of pulled his head back and said, when can you go? And my wife standing next to me said, yes, when can you go? And I sobered up quickly because I just lost $6,000. And I said, well, I could actually go to Uganda in about 3 months. He said, great. The weather will be good. The well will be in. And the people will really want to thank you in person. That's wonderful. Now, about that check, because you know Nick, and you're not going to get away from him. You promise him a check, you're going to give it to him. Well, I went to Uganda. I took my oldest daughter, an attorney, and my then 10-year-old grandson to check it out. And before I went, I started attending some meetings just as a visitor. And I liked what I saw about the charity, but I reserved my real opinion until I went to Uganda and spent some time there seeing what they're actually doing. And I came back and I told my wife, I said, honey, I would like to sell my interest in my law firm and become a contract lawyer for the firm and spend the rest of my life doing this. And she said, do we have to move to Uganda? And I said, no, we don't have to use it. But we aren't going to get paid because this is a volunteer position. All of our board members are volunteers. None of them get paid. And I said, it's going to cost a lot of money because money's going to be going out to this charity, not coming in. And she said, you know, do what you need to do, you know.
Isn't that great that you have the support of your wife? What a wonderful woman. That's a major change for somebody.
Yeah.
Family likes security and likes safety, and you're sort of giving up a bit of that.
Oh, yeah, completely. Well, I've known her for a while because I met her. She's a younger woman. I should probably tell you that straight out. I met her when she was in first grade. And I was a little older than that. I was in second grade. And we weren't allowed to formally date until she was 16, and I was 16 and a half. But we've been married 54 years, and it's been a wonderful run. I was trying to think the other day can I remember a single event in our 54 years of marriage where she was less than gracious to other people? Was she ever nasty or sharp or... And I could not think of a single time when she was ever less than gracious to people. I wish I could say that about myself, but I've snapped at people. When I put my head on the pillow at night, I do kind of an analysis of the day.
Oh, do you?
Yeah. What did I do right? What did I do wrong? What could I have done better? And there's times when I snapped and was nasty to people, or needlessly. I didn't go out of my way to do the right thing. I let something slide. I can't ever remember my wife doing that.
What a wonderful woman. That is great. You know what I want to do? I want to know, you decided to totally change your career, your the way you're spending the time, the way you're devoting your energy, what you consider important in life. And I want to know, what is it about Wells of Life? Don't answer because we're going to take a break.
Okay.
But I want to know, what is it about Wells of Life that attracted you, that made you, that encouraged you to make such a significant change? So let's take a break, and then we're going to come right back to that question.
Okay.
Hi, this is Charlie Hedges, and you're listening to The Next Chapter with Charlie, and I am here with an extraordinary individual, Esquire Pete Callahan. I'd like to make it official there, buddy, who is a successful civil litigator, mm-hmm. Educator, corporate leader, but dropped most of that just to do that part-time to spend your time with Wells of Life. You left a very successful corporate law opportunity to devote your time to a charity. What is it? What was it about Wells of Life that made you say, I need to make a change over to this?
Well, there's two parts to that. And I wish you had given me more time during our break and I could have organized my thoughts a little bit better. But I'll tell you the practical reasons and the emotional reasons. I really went to Uganda with a chip on my shoulder to check out this charity because I didn't really believe the every penny goes to a well story. That didn't make any sense to me. Now, before I went, I had 3 months after our meeting that I described a minute ago, and I've understood how the charity would finance their overhead. And so, but I still went to Uganda with a bit of chip on my shoulder because I had been I would call it a cultural Christian for all of my life at that time. I went to parochial grammar school, high school, college, and law schools. I attended church regularly. I wrote a lot of checks to church and other charities, including a lot of veterans charities. And I got ripped off by some of those charities. And so I had a bit of a chip on my shoulder when I first met Nick and told him I was going to close down his charity and send him to jail. But I went to Uganda with an open mind, but a very not suspicious, but questioning attitude. And first off, I saw the need over there. The need is compelling. One out of five kids dying from drinking dirty water before the age of five. One out of five children dies before the age of five. And think about the other ones that don't die. They've got dirty water in their brains, which don't work very well. They're
stunted
sick all their
growth.
Lives. You know, girls aren't going to school. And so, number one, I was compelled by the need and the fact that the solution was right there. Kids were dying from dirty water when clean water was 100, 200 feet away from them, but straight underground. And so the solution to the contaminated water was right there, and Wells of Life didn't waste any of the money. It wasn't a start-at-the-top, trickle-down effect like the UN or most big government projects. What impressed me about Wells of Life is they went in at the village level and worked with the people in the village to solve the problem, not in Uganda, not all over the world, but in that particular village. And the effort that I did to my well, for example, the well that I financed, and Nick got that $6,000 from me, I saw the changes it made in that village, and it made those changes relatively permanent. The well's going to last 20, 25 years if they take care of it, and we try and teach them how to take care of it. It's going to be efficient. It's going to be effective. It's going to be quick, and it's going to be a solution. And so that impressed me. That was the rational part of the decision. The emotional side of the decision is my church has a hymn that they sing. I don't know if you ever heard it. You know, here I am, Lord. Is it I, Lord? I have heard you calling in the night. I will go, Lord, if you lead me. I will hold your people in my heart. And I heard a group of children singing that song in a ramshackle church in rural Uganda, barefoot kids with raggedy clothes, the only clothes they owned. A lot of them owned a shirt and a pair of shorts and no shoes. And, you know, I heard God say, do I need to do the St. Paul thing? Do I need to knock you off of your ass and with a lightning bolt? And I said, no. Well, he said, you've been singing, here I am, Lord. Is it I, Lord? Okay, look around. This is what you need to do. And I looked around and I thought, okay, this is what I need to do. California has, I think, 140,000 lawyers. They don't really need me here in California anymore. These people need me, and I can make a difference in their lives. And I can make a difference in my own life, candidly. And so that's what I decided to do.
It sounds almost like a perfect storm. If you got, I see three elements coming together, and I see one of them is that you were already successful as an attorney, and kind of had your fill of that. You know, and mm-hmm. and like you said, 140,000 attorney. You know what difference does one more make? You found a charity that you felt was legitimate. And I want to talk more about the benefits of what's going on with Wells of Life. But then also, tell me about this God influence, because you kind of described yourself, if I understood it correctly, you described yourself as sort of a moderate Catholic. You know, I mean, that you attended, you were very Catholic, mm-hmm. but it wasn't in your heart as much. But God sort of seemed to invade your life, and give you insight into what you want to do.
Well, you know, and I hesitate to talk about that because I don't like to try to push my religion down anybody's throat.
No, I don't want you. You're not pushing. You're just talking about yours.
Okay. In fact, I still do fly Southwest a lot. And the best way to have an empty seat on both sides, you and Southwest, incidentally, is just to wear a T-shirt that says, "Let me tell you about my religion," and then smile at everybody that comes down the aisle.
With a Bible in your lap.
And look like you want to talk to them. And none of them will ever sit in either one of those seats. But you're right. I consider myself a cultural Christian, cultural Catholic, as opposed to a committed one. And in Uganda, I really decided that I needed to commit, because I believe that God spoke to me in that Ugandan church and said, you know, what are you doing with your life? Where are you going with your life? What do you believe in? What do you want to accomplish in your life? Think about this for a second. And I thought about it for more than a second. And I really heard a call. And so I answered that call.
That's, I would not call that a cultural, that may be a cultural Catholic, but that's a committed Christian. That anybody that can listen to the word of God and the call of God and follow the call of God and be willing to relinquish some wealth as a result of doing that, that's a big move. So there has to be something. What is it? You know, we're both committed to this organization. What is it that is so important about water? You know, there's so many charities that offer so many different wonderful, needful services, but water, you and I view water a little bit differently than just another charity opportunity.
Well, no pun intended, my favorite word. Well, I have looked at other charities, not before Wells of Life, but since Wells of Life. And I'm not going to badmouth any charity. And I've looked at specifically water charities. And there's some wonderful ones out there. But it's more of a trickle-down effect that they want to solve the water problems of the world or even the water problems of a country. And so they're looking at the big picture from the 10,000-foot level. And I've been told that that's, you know, where you have to start. You cannot start with an individual. And I think that's 100% wrong. What I liked about Wells of Life, and still do, is we come in at the low level where there's no trickle down. All of our effort, all of our money is going to go into a particular village. For a particular project, we're not going to try and solve all the problems in that village. We don't do micro loans, which are a wonderful idea. We don't do electricity. I mean, they're the villages that we go to, and I know I'm talking to the choir here, but you know, there's no electricity, there's no running water. All those things are really important. We don't try and solve those problems. The problem we try and solve is people are dying and getting sick from drinking contaminated water because it's all they have. Girls don't go to school because they are water-carrying beasts of burden, so they got to walk miles to get polluted water to bring back to poison their families. because that's all they have. And that's the problem we're going to try and solve. And we're not going to try and solve it in the whole world. We're not even going to try and solve it in all of Uganda. Not even in all of a district of Uganda, although that's another story. We're going to solve it in that village first. And when we solve it in that village, 800 to 1,200 people, then we're going to move on. Now, there's more to it than that because we have to teach them other concepts, wash, sanitation, hygiene, well repair, and all those things. But it starts with these people are in desperate need of access to clean water. Let's solve that problem here in this village, and then we'll move on to the next village. I liked accomplishing things. When I was a young boy, I fought with my mother because she wanted me to work on Saturdays around the house and help. And I would say to her, Mom, give me a list of jobs so that I can do those jobs. I know what's coming up, and to her approval, of course, and then, you know, I can go out and play baseball. And her attitude is, no, that doesn't work that way, son. You're mine for all of Saturday. I'll find work for you. And I really resented that, and I never liked that to this day. I want to have a project that I can work on and finish and then be satisfied that I've done a good job, and I'll go on to the next one. And that's I like that approach with Wells of Life. They don't try and solve everything all at once. They solve the problems of a single village one at a time. And how many wells do we have, Charlie? 600 plus? How many?
Six where we funded up to 600, I believe it's 637 wells. Today.
New wells. And how many have we repaired, broken wells? Because when I went to Uganda, that was one of the things that broke my heart, to go to a village that has a broken well. And they would say, we need a new well. We want a new well. And I would think, well, I would like to be younger, thinner, smarter, richer. None of that's going to happen. I am what I am. You need a well. There is a well. Why is it broken? Well, we don't know. Well, who drilled it? Well, we don't know. Well, can it be fixed? We don't know. We need a new well. I said, well, wait a minute. We've already got part of a well right here. We've got a hole in the ground, which is a good start.
That's the deal.
Yeah, yeah. And there's machinery in there. It may not be working, but maybe it does work. Let's find out what's wrong with this well. And while I think new wells are a tremendous benefit to somebody that doesn't have any well, I'm excited about our repair, Operation Restoration, we call it, of repairing broken wells. Because, you know, what's worse than never having clean water? What's worse than that is having clean water and then losing it.
Oh, I am so in agreement. You know, we started maybe a year and a half ago doing what we call Operation Restoration, mm-hmm. where we go in one district. There are 320 non-functioning wells, and our goal is by 2025 is to completely restore all 322 wells or 320 wells. And so you're taking those exact people that had solution, that had clean water, and now they don't. And mm-hmm. it's a much simpler fix and much quicker, and it's a tremendous opportunity.
Can I throw a rose at you just quickly?
Please.
And that is, when I started with Wells of Life, the emphasis was and still is drilling water wells or fixing water wells. But since you came aboard, the emphasis also now is on sanitation and hygiene, which triples the value of the clean water. I think that is a tremendous advantage that so many charities, like the abandoned well, they don't know who drilled it. People would drill and run. They would drill a well, feel good about it, take some pictures, leave, and never teach the village about how to use the water, the sanitation and hygiene, and how to maintain the well. And these are very, as you know, very primitive places we're going. No water.
Very primitive.
Yeah, no
very
water, primitive. No electricity, but good people. Good yeah. people who are deeply yeah. appreciative.
Yeah.
I fell in love with the people of rural Uganda. I haven't spent a lot of time in the city, but city people, whether it's San Francisco or Kampala, are a different breed than rural people. And there's more people on the make and what can I get out of this relationship, where the people in the villages have nothing, but they're very happy. They have their faith. They have a belief in family. They're just lovely people, and they are extremely grateful.
Extremely grateful. And you were, I tell you, you were so fun. The one or two trips that we've taken, and we've both been to Uganda several times, but I think we've only been together maybe once or twice.
Yeah, we've overlapped a couple times,
yeah,
but that's it.
But you were so fun because I have seen you go out there, and then what our listeners need to know is that when we visit, when we take a donor to visit their well, the entire village shows up.
Mm-hmm.
They're singing songs, they're dancing, they're beating drums, and we have video of you out there with little grass skirts dancing with the ladies, getting on the drums and playing the drums. You know, you just ingratiate yourself with the communities because you truly seem to embrace a love for these people.
Do you have time for two short stories?
I do have time for two short stories.
All right. And when we visited the Callahan Well, that's the well that we financed, I can't pronounce the name of the village, and they changed their, as you know, they changed their names every once in a while. When we arrived, everybody was singing and waving palm leaves and dancing and all this kind of stuff. And I saw some kid standing in the back, probably about 14, 15 years old. And I noticed he had a football on his T-shirt, and it said Irvine Football, UC Irvine. I thought, hey, I didn't know they had a football team. And I don't think they do.
No, they don't.
Yeah, but I thought, well, that's interesting. But this kid, he was about 15, and he was too cool to sing the songs with the other kids. And he was too cool to do the dancing. He had two or three of his friends that were that age, you know, where they're teenagers. So I had an eye on him. And when we got a little break and I got away from, you know, giving speeches and shaking hands and all the rest of that, I said to him, where'd you get the football shirt? And he said, well, where do you think? It came in a care package. And when I got close, I saw it wasn't Irvine. It was Irving Football. Irving, Texas. Okay.
From Irving, Texas.
So,
yeah.
He said, I saw your football shirt. And he said, well, I grabbed this one because I'm a football player. Can I ask you a couple questions about football? And I said, sure. He says, how do you kick this thing? It's going to bounce crazy. And, because he said, I'm a football player and I would never play with, well, he's a soccer player.
Thinking soccer, yes.
And I said, well, it's you can throw the ball. Because of the, and he said, well, that makes sense. I figured that. So it's sort of like rugby then. You can throw the ball too. And I said, you can throw the ball the whole length of the pitch using a soccer term. And he said, okay, well, then why don't you call it throw ball? And I said, well, we just started calling it football. He says, do you kick it at all? I said, well, we start the game with a kickoff and stuff like that. But he says, this kid is no dummy. He was able to figure out that this shape of an American football would not be able to be played with soccer. So I thought that was interesting. Then finally it came time to leave and it was starting to rain and the mosquitoes were starting to come out. And I'm heading for the van and I'm trying to get my daughter and my grandson who were singing and dancing and carrying on. This kid comes up to me and he said, oh, listen, I want to thank you for the well and coming to our village. And I said, oh, that's fine. You know, it's starting to rain. You know, hey, Jen, come on, let's go. And he said, hey, I'm talking to you. Pay attention. And I thought, all right, mouthy little guy. And he looked me in the eye and he said, I want to thank you for coming to this village and bringing your wife and young son. They insisted that my daughter was my wife. He said, the fact that you came here is more important than the well because my parents had a chance to thank you in person. And that's very important to us. If somebody does something wonderful for us, and this well is wonderful, we feel an obligation to at least thank them. And I said, oh, okay. And he said, you don't understand. He said, you're still not getting it. He said, I'll bet you it cost you three times as much to fly your wife and son out here as it did to drill the well. And the fact that you came and let us thank you in person is the biggest thing that's ever happened to this village, the biggest thing that's ever happened to my family. My sister can go to school now. This is a very good thing you've done. And he looked me in the eye, and I thought, God, first off, where's the video guy? Secondly, can I sneak this kid back and sign him up and go to UCI? Kid's going to be a genius. That's the quality of the people over there, the appreciation, but also the just basic common sense. These are not people that don't understand what airplanes are. They all got cell phones, not all, but a lot of them have cell phones.
Most of them,
yeah. There are very few. I never saw a landline except in a hotel. They don't use money because they use cash transfers on their cell phone. They're not stupid people. They're not ignorant people. But I another thing I can tell you about, a second story, and I'll go fast, is I met an old man that had me into his home, which was basically a mud hut with a straw roof, and the floor was mahogany. Actually, it wasn't mahogany. It was a mix of mud and buffalo dung that had been polished, and it looked like mahogany. It felt like mahogany. It smelled like mahogany. But he had a little fire going out in front of his door, and I talked to him for a little bit. Old man, bad teeth, and he said, I said, how do you keep people here in the village when they have cell phones and don't they want to leave? And he told me, well, the boys all want a motorbike and the girls all want to be fashion models. And so they go to the big city and the boys get involved in drugs and the girls become prostitutes and they sometimes come back broken. And we take them back and we try to restore their lives. But he said, we try and stop them from leaving in the first place because we tell them, why do you want a motorbike? Why do you want to be a fashion model? Because they'll be happy then. And he said, we try and tell them, you can be happy in this village. You can find happiness here that you can't buy anywhere else. If you stay in this village and marry a girl from the next village, you will live with your parents and your grandparents, and you will see your children born here, and you will see your children's children. Everything you need, you have. You don't need five sets of clothes. All you need is one set of clothes. You don't need a house with indoor plumbing. What you need is to be with people that love you, and that you love back, and that you can be happy. Uganda is 85% Christian. And he said, this guy had painted on the side of his hut there, Jesus is the living water. So I didn't try and tell him about Jesus. I mean, he could tell me about Jesus. And I said, do you have any luck selling that? That sounds like a hard sell. And he said, sometimes, sometimes not. But he said, you know, it's all true. And if you tell people the truth, they often will believe you. I thought, wow, this guy. And we talked a little bit about, I said, are you happy with your life? You think you should have done something different with your life? And he said, no, I'm happy with my life. He pointed out that's my daughter over there, and that's my granddaughter. And he said, I'm very happy here. And this guy had literally nothing compared to you and I, but he had happiness.
Yeah, we really need to emphasize the degree of poverty that we face when we go to rural Uganda. When we say rural Uganda, we mean really rural Uganda. There are no paved roads.
Right.
The dirt roads are filled with ruts.
There's no roads.
Filled with holes. I mean, it is horrible driving, and we have to go way, because we drill in very rural, so we go way back in the sticks, and the people many times are wearing truly ragged, torn clothes, mm-hmm. kids barefoot. And yet, like you said, there's some part of me that wants to say they're happier than a lot of people here.
They are. That's true.
They do not have the stresses, and they don't need psychologists.
Yeah. Well, you and I have both emptied our suitcases over there and given away all the clothes that we brought and flew back with what was on our back on an empty suitcase. But they are really contented and happy, most of them. There is a tremendous amount that we can do there. There's an educated, caring population, but they've been abandoned by many of the major charities, by many of the governmental agencies. and they really desperately need our help. And it's very rewarding. I mean, I tell people, they ask me, how much did you get paid? And I said, my reward is out of this world. And they think, oh, really, how much? And I said, no, zero, but it's out of this world. I will be repaid tenfold. And I really do believe that because I've already been paid tenfold. To look
yes,
at people in
right.
the eye, to have, how many times has anybody ever really sincerely thanked you from the bottom of their heart? I can say that's happened to me hundreds of times.
Oh, truly. The
people, all of them were over there.
On their knees, grandfathers, grandmothers,
yeah.
young kids.
Yeah.
It's just, it's amazing. Now, look, we're running kind of near on our time, but
okay.
I do have a very important question that I want you to answer. And
what's
don't
that?
Be concerned about you have to rush. But as we have discussed, Pete, you told me that you have a passion for inspiring younger adults to get involved in charities. And you said if you had a regret in mm-hmm. your life, it was that you did not do this sooner. Can you talk to me about that?
Yes, I can. But then give me the cutoff sign when we're out of time. That is my only regret that in life. Other than that, I mean, I married a wonderful woman. I've had wonderful children and grandchildren. I had a successful career. I've made a lot of money. I've donated a lot of money, especially since Wells Life came along. This last couple of years as Wells of Life has been the most satisfying time of my life, and I wish I'd started it when I was 30 years old or 40. But what I tell young people is find something that you believe in, and I don't care if it's water in rural Uganda or homelessness in Los Angeles or anything else, but find something that really touches your heart, and then pay attention to what's going on. Don't look at their website, because websites basically are advertising material. Start attending meetings, start going to meetings, start seeing what they're doing in the field, and find out where check the money flow. Where's the money coming from? Where's the money going? How's it being spent? And is it making a difference? How effective is it? And dig in and spend a year or so really finding out, is this something that I want to commit my life to? And if it passes those tests, and that's what I did with Wells of Life. As I said, I went in with a chip on my shoulder. Then you can commit. And I know people who send $100 here and $50 there and $500 there. And they do a lot of different charities, which is fine if that's, you know, what they want to do. But they're not really doing anything. They're putting drop in the bucket.
Yeah, they're not making huge impact on the company.
Yeah, they're not solving anybody's problem. And if you can find a charity that is solving problems and you can see that for yourself and follow up on it, then you should spend your time, your money, and your life doing that. It can be very, very rewarding.
Is it not, you know, both of us being, you know, I hate to use the word religious, but and I don't want to limit us to Christian, but we're both Christian people, and service and helping other people is the main tenet. It's one of the main tenets of our faith.
It's the main tenet of most faiths, and it's an important part of people that have no faith. I think humans are built, and we can talk about who builds them, but that's another story. But I think humans are hardwired to help other people. And I come across people that are not charitable at all, and they don't care about other people, and they don't give anything to charity. And I don't find them usually to be happy people. I find them to be closed down, unhappy people. The happiest people I know are the people that help others. And if you want to be happy in life, it's not going to come from money. We know that from the movie stars that commit suicide and die on drugs, et cetera, et cetera. And certainly money is very nice to have. Don't get me wrong. But money isn't going to buy happiness, and it's not going to make it even easier to have happiness. Money is a good thing. Believe me, it's what you do with it and how it shapes your life. And if money is the big criteria and you judge yourself by the toys that you buy, that you are driving the Ferrari or not, you're not going to be happy at the end of your life. When you look, stop and look back, that you're going to have that same closed-in mentality that, you know, I'm a millionaire, you say to yourself, or a multimillionaire, but I'm not a billionaire, and so I failed in life. If money's going to be the only criteria, I think all of us are hardwired to look for happiness, and I think all of us are hardwired to find that happiness in helping others.
Yeah, all of us are hardwired to love, Pete. And you know, that is love. All of us are hardwired to give. God is a giving God. That is the main aspect, as you and I were talking about, love and, you know, complex theology of Trinity, which we're not about to bring here, but it's but it's all about love. It's all about God is in essence love, and when we imitate the nature of God, in any religion, we
or no religion
or no, perfectly.
Yeah.
If we imitate that image of love, that is what's going to give us fulfillment. That's what's going to make a difference in our life. And Pete Callahan, I got to tell you, you have made a difference in so many people's lives. As chairman of the board, I have so much respect for you. You have such an impact on the organization. Your passion, your intelligence, what you bring to the company is just to the company. I call it the company,
yeah,
to our
mean.
Charity, is to Wells of Life is just amazing. So let's say somebody's inspired by what you had to say, and they're inspired to look into Wells of Life. How would you suggest they do that?
Contact me. That's a good start. And my cell phone number is 714-264-5594. I'll repeat that in just a second.
I will put that in the show notes.
Okay.
That will be in the show notes, and so they can call you. But go ahead and say number again.
And I will tell you about Wells of Life. I won't try and necessarily sell you on Wells of Life, but I'll tell you about it. And it's something that you should volunteer for, to see, go in with your eyes open and test it yourself and see if this is something that you believe in and if the promises that we make on our website are accurate or not. And decide that for yourself with a rational, I'd even put a chip on your shoulder, because there are so many charities that are illegitimate ripoffs,
scamming people.
And particularly water charities in Africa. That may be the worst because they're so far away. Find out what we do and check it out and see if it's something that you believe in. And if it is, welcome aboard. We can use volunteers. We can use donors. We can use both. But we can... If you go to Uganda, it'll change your life. I warn people, careful. Don't go if you don't want your life changed. Now, there's been a couple that have gone and it hasn't changed their life, but most of the people come back different. And I saw the change in my grandson, for example. I saw the change in my daughter. And I know about the change in me.
Yeah, you know, and I'm the same. I'm exactly the same. I had Nick on the podcast a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Next thing I know, within 30 days, I was funding Wells, and within 2 months, I was in Uganda and a trustee. And within 2 months after that, I was on the board. And I am fully, you know, it takes up a full third of my life right now, and it is just such rewarding work. It's hard work,
yeah.
And it's challenging work, but you take a look at what we are doing, and like you said, if we go to Uganda, you will never. My trip to Uganda, the first thing I wrote, my life will never be the same.
That's true. And listen, let me tell you what's been exciting for me today, and that is being here in the studio with you, because I've heard your song on the radio or the cell phone, you know, many, many times, and now I got to hear it in person.
Well, Pete, thank you so much for coming. I know your time is busy. You've got so many things to do. We're here for year-end annual planning, and you are so articulate, so bright, and mostly so loving and giving. I really appreciate you as a person, Pete Callahan.
Well, thank you, and I gotta say, Charlie, kind words. I appreciate them, and they're true. But I've gotten so much more out of Wells of Life than I've given, so much more.
You know, and I think I think that is the way I would like to close our podcast.
Okay.
Is that the word St. Paul repeating Jesus, it is better to give than receive. And that's there is such deep meaning to that simple sentence.
Yes.
In the giving, we are so much more rewarded. And Wells of Life is an opportunity. And if it's not Wells of Life, I encourage you to find any charity that you can give to, that you can support people in need.
Well, I would encourage anybody to listen to your podcasts, because you're going to pick up a lot of good information. You just have to mull it over in your mind and let it sink in.
That's kind of you. Pete Callahan, it's been great spending time with you. Let me thank our listeners for tuning in to The Next Chapter with Charlie, and encourage you to check out our website, thenextchapter.life. We have a weekly blog. We have a weekly podcast. And our goal is to help you find meaning, purpose, adventure, and awe. And you have given us, I think, all three or four.
Thank you,
Pete Callahan, thank you. Until next, this is Charlie Hedges signing off. Bye for now.